And good morning, everyone, and welcome to 2016. Can you believe it's already 5 days into the new year? 5 whole days of almost an entire week. Well. Anyway, welcome to the other side of midnight, that kind of magic time between dusk and dawn where the things we look at this time of night appear a little different and take on a more resonant atmosphere or perception or persona, perhaps, than they do when we kind of think about them sometimes during daylight. That is definitely going to be true about this morning's program because we're going to go boldly where I wanted to go for some time, and I was looking for exactly the right guy to go there with, and I think we have found him, so momentarily we shall begin. Before we do that, however, I've got a couple of items. One is, remember how I did a show several months ago with, I think, Steve Bassett and Grant Cameron, and maybe Don Ecker was on the show too? We were talking about Hillary, and we were talking about the emails, and we're talking about, you know, various speculations and scenarios as to why she had a private server. And my theory of the case was that all of the communications between her and John Podesta and the Rockefellers and the Rockefeller Initiative and everything having to do with ETs and things upstairs that go bump in the night, which are on a timetable for disclosure, were part of that conversation. And therefore, they could not be conducted on a public server at the U.S. State Department, but literally had to be jury-rigged on a private system where somebody might be able to pass information without others noticing. Anyway, as part of that conversation, we in our discussion that night, we predicted that Hillary and UFOs would become a mainstream topic, that it had to be before the nomination process, before, of course, the election. If the timetable is going to be served, if, in fact, disclosure is coming on a schedule, then something mainstream-wise would have to break vis-a-vis Hillary and UFOs. And lo and behold, as the new year dawned a few days ago in an editorial board meeting with the Conway, New Hampshire newspaper, the Conway something or other, I forget what the name is. But anyway, in sitting with the editorial board, she was asked some questions about UFOs by one of the board members, and she answered. And she talked about all kinds of things she was going to do, including set up a task force to find out what's going on at Area 51. Now, various mainstream news outlets, and I've been in touch with Steve on this since, various mainstream outlets did not touch this until today. Today, particularly tonight, if you look through the rankings on the Yahoo News feeds or some of the other news feeds, you'll see that there are several stories from several different outlets now on Hillary and UFOs and her statements to the editorial board of the Conway newspaper, et cetera, et cetera. CNN is treating it as a joke, that she was making jokes. Other outlets are treating it differently. It's going to be intriguing to see how this kind of settles down. Anyway, as part of this week, which is a week devoted to kind of the new year and predictions, I want to look at from a different set of perspectives, wide range of perspectives, predictions for what will be happening in the new year. And perhaps beyond, because, you know, years don't really end where we think they do. They have repercussions, as we're going to be discussing tonight, in media where repercussions have importance. So Hillary says she's going to look into UFOs if she is elected president of the United States. Later on in the week, as part of our looking forward to the surroundings of disclosure, which also include ruins, out there. There's ruins, folks, out there. We're going to have Steve Bassett on, I think that's Friday morning, and we're going to talk about Hillary and a lot of other stuff and kind of come up to date on where we stand vis-a-vis the Congress and where we stand vis-a-vis various initiatives on UFOs and who knows what could have happened between Hillary and Trump on the subject of extraterrestrials. by Friday morning. Now, let's get to the main subject of this morning, which is to kick off this week of the new year, predictions. I wanted to do one more thing before we leave kind of news. If the way you start something kind of imprints a direction, I think we ought to start a habit here on the other side of midnight of beginning certainly the year and maybe a few shows with news which is affirmative of the truism that I have expressed here many times vis-a-vis the physics, hyperdimensional physics, that if you look around you now, you can see that the good are getting better and the bad are getting worse. Well, in the category of the good are getting better, a Delta Airlines pilot made headlines a few days ago for his decision to turn a plane around after it had pulled away from the gate, and then he returned to pick up passengers trying to get to a funeral in Tennessee. With severe weather affecting flights across the country this week, many passengers were stranded at airports or had trouble making connecting flights. That's what happened to one family trying to get to Tennessee from Phoenix, Arizona. According to KSAZ Fox 10 Phoenix, the family was trying to get to Memphis to bury their father who had lost his battle with cancer. The family was delayed on their original Phoenix flight and left with just minutes to get to their gate in Minneapolis so they could then get to Tennessee on time. When the family arrived at the gate, the plane had already backed off from that gate and was heading toward the runway, but one of the family members was able to get hold of the pilot through, I guess, boarding gate, and the pilot decided to turn around and pick up the family so they could make their dad's funeral. Again, an example of the good. I mean, think of all the institutional pressures on that pilot. Schedules, airports, control towers, other aircraft, corporate, whatever, and yet he decided to go back. An interesting idea of someone taking it upon themselves to do the right thing. Well, we're going to be discussing a lot of the right things and decisions this morning. My guest is Eric Francis Coppolino, sometimes known to his close associates and friends as King Francis. We're going to get into that and find out why. Eric is editor of Planet Waves. We're also going to find out about that. And host of a Planet Waves FM radio. He has a weekly astrology webcast affiliated with the Pacifica Radio Network. Since beginning as an astrologer in the mid-1990s, Eric has enjoyed a dual career as a widely published horoscope writer and a personal consultant specializing in business and the arts. He is also a pioneer in mapping the psychology of the newly discovered planets via astrology, Chiron, Eris, and many others, and we're going to talk about those. But what's so interesting about Eric is that he came to this astrology kind of late in his career, which occupied totally other areas of interest. He's been an investigative reporter, won many awards, specializing particularly in fraud cases associated with chlorine-based toxins, dioxin, PCBs, and pesticides. In addition to serving Marie Claire as its astrologer currently, Eric also writes for and is a faculty member of the Omega Institute for Holistic Studies. Good morning, Eric, and welcome to the other side of midnight.
Good morning, Richard. Great to be here with you.
Well, it's certainly nice having you here. Before we get into the kind of the bulk of what we want to talk about this morning, I've got to find out how you made a kind of a left-hand turn from investigative reporting, and I'm sure that people have asked you this question before. How did you go from winning awards ferreting out the strangeness of Monsanto to looking at the celestial impact of cycles, astronomical cycles, on the patterns of our lives?
The common thread is the newspaper. I began being a news journalist back in the day of newspapers. Prior to the internet, no one had imagined such a thing. I guess maybe Al Gore or somebody had imagined it, but
there is a rumor to that effect, yes.
Yeah, you thought the whole thing up. So then when I got my first job as a newspaper writer in the mid-1980s, the editor of the paper happened to be an astrologer.
Hmm.
Now, this is not normal. You don't normally get a job for a gritty Republican small-town newspaper and get sent to cover the sewage authority and the town board and the planning board, but your editor also happens to be an astrologer.
Hmm.
So there was no astrology in the newspaper, of course, but there was plenty of astrology in the office.
Oh, how did that work?
It was kind of fun. It was kind of scary. She had the whole, you know, the whole company paying attention to things like Mercury retrograde, which happens in a few hours from now.
Oh, really? It's that close?
I thought we hold on. We can take a look at that. So that began an association with newspapers and with astrology. And it turns out that when years later, after, you know, I was in the peak of doing my work on particularly on the PCB issue, I had covered higher education and beverage alcohol and the nursing shortage and then got involved in covering chemicals. Around late in that era, someone suggested that I read the New York Post horoscope because they knew that I read tarot cards and that I had a bit of a mystical streak and, you know, studied spirituality. And they said, you'll like the Patrick Walker horoscope in the New York Post.
And roughly what year was this?
Around 93.
Okay.
And so I started reading the 92, 93, started the Patrick Walker horoscope in the Post. And it was so amazing that I had to figure out how he did it.
Well, why was it amazing?
The astuteness of what he would say, the timing of his suggestions, the particular voice that he worked in, this very soulful. Mind you, I mean, this is not – he's not writing books like Leo Tolstoy. These are 50-word horoscopes that are stuck in with the jumble and the family circus on the comic page of the Post. But they were so eloquent that he really did build up a worldwide following writing these columns. And I read them every day for about – kept having these astonishing synchronicities. And I never experienced anything like it. And mind you, it's coming from a newspaper. And so – at this time, I was in
– And so therefore you would say it's kind of like what, mass-produced? It's not really tailored?
Well, it's the 12-sign format. You know, it's the 12-sign
– Right, but it's not the specific individual. It's for all people who have particular signs in the zodiac.
Yeah, but it's also just for you because you pick up the paper and read it. So that a lot of that is the writing voice. The writer uses, but it's also when you divide the world into 12 as opposed to say 2, right? We tend to divide the world into young people and old people, men folk and women folk. Now we have trans folk, rich people and poor, so forth. We do a lot of dividing the world in two. Well, when you look at the world from 12 viewpoints, that's a good bit more than for almost any other thing that is categorized.
Okay.
And so when whatever he was doing, it was really speaking to me. And so on my birthday in 1994, after having my deposition taken because I was suing the state of New York in federal court for attempting to ban me from the college campus where I had uncovered the fact that their heating systems and ventilation systems were contaminated with PCBs, these toxic chemicals, and the university's response to that was to solve the problem of me by kicking me off campus. So I sued them. And in the peak of that lawsuit, on the day that I had been deposed up in the president's office, I went out after that was all over and bought an ephemeris, the ancient tool of astrologers, the position – it's a book of the positions of the planet's places. And from that night forward, I studiously read Patrick's column every night with a copy – with the ephemeris and figured out what he was doing. Mm-hmm. I hacked in basically. And after a year of doing that, I thought, well, I'll just write a column. It seemed pretty journalistic to me. It seemed like reporting on the facts, only interpreting them, which is what you do as a journalist. And I started writing a column that I still write to this day called Planet Waves.
Hmm. So you basically taught yourself astrology?
Well, I taught – using Patrick, who's quite an important mentor. I mean, the thing is that Patrick set the most important example, which is he taught me that astrology could be relevant. I knew astrologers. You know, I knew Flo Higgins, you know, who taught me a lot about journalism and what I think of as municipal cell biology. How does a town work? She was a very – she's still alive. She's down in New Jersey. Very bright woman and a smart newspaper staff. But the thing
– this was your editor who was into astrology.
Okay. Yeah, but she – astrology seemed more of a joke than anything else. It didn't – I couldn't see the use of it. And when I started reading Patrick's column in the Post, suddenly astrology became very useful as a journalistic medium because it was very pragmatic. And it was the part of the newspaper with the spiritual content, with meaning.
Hmm.
And so what he did was set the example that astrology could be relevant. That was the thing that hooked me in. And once I saw that it could be relevant, I wanted to take part in that relevance. And that's why I started studying him, just to see what he did, to see how this was possible. It was part just curiosity. I couldn't understand how he could do it. Now, I knew there had to be a way because he was doing it. So I just figured it out. And by the time – I'm not the only person this has happened to. A lot of people – I mean, I didn't come in with a skeptical viewpoint, but some people even come in as skeptics. Ah, this can't possibly work. Mm-hmm. And then they start reading their friends' charts and their own charts, and it's jaw-dropping. I mean, so there's ways in that don't require belief a priori. And I was one of those. I was just having it shown to me that it could be done.
Well, let me ask you this one then. If there's such overwhelming, empirical, convincing, compelling proof, obviously you've been around a few times, you've covered all kinds of things, you know people make claims, you know that an awful lot of life is not exactly what it's, you know, cracked up to be. If the proof is there, if the compelling empirical data is there, why is there such a stigma, you know, astrology columns in major newspapers all over the country notwithstanding, why is it relegated like the kick story at the end of the newscast, you know, the fluffy UFO story?
Yeah.
Why is astrology treated like a stepchild as opposed to a very interesting heir to hundreds of years, if not thousands of years, of practical psychology?
That is the question, Richard. So – first of all, the empirical evidence is not there. There are some studies that lean toward showing an astrological effect. There are some that fail utterly. For me,
well, there was a major French study, Gauquelin or something back.
Gauquelin data.
Yeah,
and there I can get into some of the issues with that study, but that's not what convinced me. It wasn't the empirical evidence that convinced me. It was the relevance. It was a spiritual connection. It was like listening to the Beatles and then wanting to play bass.
Yeah, but you can have something relevant that's wrong. I mean, obviously it's got to be more right than wrong for it to catch your attention.
No, it was right. They were ridiculously right things, but that doesn't make it empirical. In other words, studying it over a population and over time and having controlled studies, astrology does not hold up well to those controlled studies. And in some ways, when you attempt to apply science to astrology, you kind of unravel science. Science takes the beating because you see how science is not capable of wrapping itself around this one subject where there's so many correlations involved. Science is great if you can narrow your question down to a very specific focus. What is the effect level of that chemical in that group of rats? That's a testable hypothesis. Without that, you haven't started the ignition of science. Now, it would be an interesting sociological study to look at who resonates. Now, Neil deGrasse Tyson goes around the country telling people that, you know, 60% of the room will agree with any one horoscope. I want to see his empirical data on that. But there is none. There is none. So –
well, there's a lot of arm waving on the other side, but
and yes, and it threatens something, and there's a threat.
When I say empirical, I'm talking about if you got a body of people, a population of people, and X number are going to be Virgos, and X number are going to be Tauruses, and X number are going to be Geminis. Cannot you track those statistics of those populations to see if the trends as reflected in sun signs, we're only obviously looking at sun signs, if that in fact correlates to population trends. I mean, that's what I mean by empirical evidence.
Oh, you could. I mean, you could make a testable hypothesis. It's more of a psychological study, though, than anything else, right? It's how do you respond to that? Because the thing is that whenever you get astrology
– But isn't that psychology from square one? I mean, psychology has always been a stepchild science trying to pretend it was a real science, you know, like physics or chemistry. And it uses statistics and it uses numbers and it uses control groups and it uses blind studies. And ultimately, it's incredibly subjective.
Sure, astrology is totally subjective.
Yeah. So what
it's
makes it different than psychology?
Of the astrologer.
What makes it any different than psychology then?
Well,
even
you
if
could
there's
say
no
it's a
theory,
form of yes.
Even if there's no theory as to how it works, and that's a whole other discussion we'll get to in a while.
Well, it is a kind of psychology in modern day. But the thing is that it's dependent upon these charts that are unique. Because the planets never come back to the same positions ever, you know, and there's a lot of factors now. So when you've got, you know, my basic chart has 25 points, those 25 points never realign. And even if they did, it would be every like 50 or 100,000 years. I mean, there's no – they just don't. You know, there's too many variables. You know, Pluto would have to be back in Capricorn and Eris back in Aries. And that's like, well, that's not going to even happen. Just if you take the two slowest planets, you're not going to find them in the same positions. So then you add things like the moon, variables. This is every chart is unique. Every moment is unique. This is one of the underlying, you might say, the message of the medium of astrology is that every moment is unique as described by the astrology charts. Mm-hmm. So it becomes squirrely to pin it to a paradigm. But the thing is, it's always a description of a tree. It's always it's basically when it's done well, it's a poetic decision, a description of a natural phenomenon that people resonate with. So it's always a story. I think astrology comes out of the storytelling tradition, more the shamanic tradition of describing the night sky than any scientific paradigm.
Okay.
It's a story that whatever I do is including what I'm saying now. So when I write the monthly horoscope for Marie Claire magazine for April or whatever I'm doing right now, that's a story. I look at the chart and I tell a tale. And if people resonate with that tale, they do. And they're more likely to, I think, because I have a technique of choosing what tale to tell based on the chart that I'm using. So there's a coherence. There's a thread to the plot, which is the chart. Psychology wouldn't even – you couldn't – I mean it would be fun to kind of write a psychological horoscope column, but how would you categorize it? Nervous Nelly. You know, I once did one on April Fool's Day with emoticons. I just randomly picked 12 emoticons.
Yeah.
It's called the Emotoscope. It should still be online. emotoscope.com. And it was great fun. Now, they correlated loosely. You know, I used – emoticons that spoofed the signs, you know, like the pumpkin with sunglasses was Scorpio.
Okay.
And the because it's spooky, right? And then the cutesy emoticon with the heart shaped glasses was Taurus, you know. I think that the reason astrology pisses people off is that it completely defies all of the things we say we respect. It's reviled by both religion and science. There is not much in that category. That is a special category, right? Think about it. Usually it's religion versus science. And then here comes astrology. Well, it's kind of science-y because everything's based on math and astronomy and physics. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of religious-y because we're like listening to the sky for the voice of God. That's kind of freaky. We're actually doing it. But then it stands apart from both and it's totally its own thing. And, you know, where the thing is with astrologers and astrology, it doesn't kowtow to either of those two dominant positions, nor is it much of a use for atheists who think it's bullshit. So, you know, it basically manages to piss off all the major factions, the intelligentsia, the religious people and the pseudoscience people who are told that NyQuil is good for you. Just chug this stuff down.
So you started reading this column.
Yeah.
And you noticed that there were patterns. Obviously, you were reading your own horoscope, right?
Yeah, I'm reading Pisces. I was reading Pisces. That's where the information was coming through because I'm born in March, so I'm a Pisces, and I just would read it. You know, I just flip open the paper and casually read it, not expecting anything. And it was always brilliant. I mean, the day that my story made the New York Times, at a certain point, I was kind of a heretic covering the PCB story too, because I was going against the state scientific establishment saying, you guys have a problem with these buildings and the compounding problem is that students live there and you haven't even tested them. And finally, a New York Times writer found out what I was doing and did a piece about me. And on that day, the Post horoscope said, you know, what happens next? It was the day before the Times column came out. What happens next will more than make up for previous, you know, business and financial disasters. Boom. General statement, right? Mm-hmm. But damn, the next day I'm on page B1 of the New York Times. That is what happened next. And so that is that's kind of cool. And it's also beautiful. It's poetic in the poetry of life.
And there's a lot of room for interpretation.
There has to be. Because everyone's different, but there's room for interpretation in all literature. Think about how UFOs may have been perceived. Robert Anton Wilson tells the story of the leprechauns who came out of the forest and gave people cornbread. And then he hears the story of a spacecraft landing, and the space people get out of the spaceship and offer the person cornbread. He's like, maybe it's the same people offering the cornbread.
That was in Kansas somewhere, and it was back in the 50s or 60s, I think, yes.
And then he found the old myths of leprechauns or somebody coming out of the forest and offering cornbread. So he's like, well, maybe it's the same people, only we see them as space aliens, and they saw them as leprechauns.
Interesting.
They come in the cultural garb that we're ready to see. So we're really talking about, you know, describing the grand illusion, and astrology is just one kind of fun way to do it that's a cultural meeting place. All that little Aries slot in my column is a place where I'm going to write something and you're going to read it.
Okay.
You know, I make no claims that it's anything special, but I do sincerely read the charts and study my craft and teach my craft, and I can explain why I'm saying something. I can – you know, obviously, and if I have 100 words or 50 words to say it, I can't say why I'm saying it in that column, but I can then teach what I did.
Okay.
And it's not easy to learn.
Oh, no, I imagine it isn't. Okay, hold
it there.
It's
like teaching poetry. It's like you can teach people to read poetry. It's not easy to teach them to write it, though.
All right, let's get specific in the next segment. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guest this morning is Eric Francis. I'm just going to call him Eric.
That's good.
We're discussing astrology, how it might work, the parallels with psychology. We're going to get specific in the next segment, and we're going to talk about some things in transition from administrations to eras to epochs to, well, things in transition. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. And we're back this morning on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is Eric Francis
Coppolino.
Coppolino, I'm sorry.
No worries.
My screen slipped here, and you had double letters for a moment. Eric is telling us about how astrology is really akin to psychology, and that if you can analyze one, even though we don't know the modalities under how it works, at least we don't think we do, you can analyze a lot of people and find interesting developments and trends. Why don't we start with some specifics? Why don't we talk about the Obama administration, since we're about to slide into a new administration, whatever that one is. But The astrology of the Obama era, I find really intriguing, if in fact we're getting any kind of empirical data at all.
So what are you familiar with it, or should I briefly recap?
No, just start at the beginning because people are not going to be familiar. Okay.
Yeah. So the there's two ways to look at the astrology of the Obama administration, at least. There's a lot of ways to come at astrology. One of the ways is on the wider sweeping historical trend, and that the wave that has come through society since the basically Obama campaign is Pluto in Capricorn. So Pluto is a – till recently was the slowest moving planet that we knew of. It takes 2.5 centuries to go around the sun. It could take 12 to 20 years, depending on where it is in its orbit, to go through a sign. So if it's at perihelion, it goes quicker, 12 years. Aphelion, it takes 20 years to go around. So now it's halfway between. So it's taking about 15 years to go through a sign. So it's not that quick.
When you say go through a sign, you mean a zodiacal sign.
Zodiacal sign, yeah.
Now, the orbit of Pluto is so inclined, 17 degrees. Does it really go through all 12 zodiacal signs?
As far as we know, it does. That's not that crazy of a – and we can measure things with very steep inclinations. For example, a thing called Icarus spends most of its time in Aquarius. Like it goes through all 12 signs – in like 1/12 of its orbit, and then spends the other 80% of its orbit in Aquarius. So that's how it looks.
Because of this very elongated orbit. Now Pluto
elongated and angular against the ecliptic.
Okay.
So with Pluto it's similar, but not that bad compared to other things that we know, like Chiron. And so Pluto in Capricorn is, first of all, a story of massive structural change. Pluto and Sag, the previous era from the 90s, around 95 through around 06, 07, actually 08, was because it transitions from 07 to 08, was the globalism era. Global, like world trade agreements, world beat music, global food. Before Pluto and Sag, everybody was a lot more domestic and less exotic.
When you say Sag, you mean Sagittarius.
Pluto and Sagittarius. And so before that, in the mid-90s, things were pretty domestic. Now there's a sushi bar on every corner. and that's like
– I thought that was a Starbucks. You mean that sushi they're selling? Okay.
Well, see, it is – it's astral because it's Starbucks. So and then music became more international and also isms took over, including Christianity, fundamentalism really, and then – fundamentalist Muslim thinking, Islamist thinking, right? Mm-hmm. So we go through that 12 years and suddenly the world has become Sagittarified by Pluto. A good word for it, because at the middle of the Sagittarification was the 9/11 incident. Pluto opposite Saturn. And this opens a door through which much evil enters. And by the time Pluto and Sag is over, people are ready for a change. And a change comes through, and if you recall, it was a real wave of change. Whatever you think of Obama, it was a real wave of change that brought him into office. There was a groundswell. It wasn't like it didn't feel like Cheney and Bush getting elected, where nobody was that excited about it. With Obama, there was an emotional movement that did it. And at the same time, if you recall, at the peak of the campaign, right as Pluto had touched Capricorn for the first time, there was a banking collapse.
You know, Eric, it's like you've been hanging out with too many NASA people. You keep using acronyms, CAP and SAG and GEM.
Sorry, I just shortened the names of science because they're long names. Capricorn.
And most people don't know them, so we have to do the long form. Yes.
What the heck is a sea goat?
That's Capricorn.
So, yeah, but what, have you ever seen one? Like, have you ever gone to the beach and seen a seagoat?
Not for a long time.
There's a reason for him being a seagoat, because up in that part of the sky, there's a big river and there's a sea monster and there's Pisces,
Eridanus,
and Aquarius. So if they had a goat, they have to give him a tail so he can swim.
So are you of the opinion that all of the astrological background is just kind of mumbo jumbo, or do you think there is a very ancient science kind of disintegrated with little tendrils that we pick up and try to use But in fact, it used to be much more sophisticated and with much better science grounding.
Well, I'm not sure it was science because that modality had not been thought of yet. They weren't – right? Science really means the proof of something in a repeatable study from hypothesis to experiment to a result that's provable. That's not quite invented yet, but there are methods. And the – when you – go back and look at the oldest known methods, which are not that old. They're really from about 500 BC. You do see more formula. It's more formula-driven. It's less imaginal. And yet, at the same time, they are require, they're kind of banking on a kind of – like there is no bull up in Taurus. It's just a thing that people see in the sky. This is, you know, this is the discussion I have with skeptics. Like, you know, Mr. Tyson tells us our zodiac is 23 degrees off. And so my reply to that is, are you really saying, are you saying there's really a bull up in Taurus and we're missing it by 23 degrees? And if only we'd look in the right place, we would see the bull.
Right.
So there's a whole, the realm of the imagination and the realm of, there's an enchantment going on with astrology where we see the story and tell the story. Now, there's many methods of astrology, and some of the most convoluted come from the 18th and 19th centuries that's so heavily formula-driven that it's just boring.
Well, that's during the rise of the Enlightenment and the idea of science, and you could apply science. What you're saying is that astrology is really more almost like soothsaying than it is a left-brain mechanistic science that we can ultimately pin down with quantities.
Till you do it. The method is not so much soothsaying because even to read a basic chart, you have to be able to make a lot of correlations that are based on a kind of a syntax. There's a syntax framework. It's like with poetry. You can bend the rules, but you ultimately you have to write something that someone understands.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a syntax to it, and there's a syntax with astrology. What's the ruler of the ascendant? What's it doing? What's the next thing it does? What was the last thing it did? How do you ascribe this question to a house? So when you're doing it, there's a lot of logic involved and a lot of translating, but it doesn't fit the bill for no method in the process fits the bill for science. I mean, for example – again, science being the testable, repeatable hypothesis, right? That's a new thing applied since Ben Franklin, right?
Mm-hmm. Roughly, yes.
So that's very new in the history of thought, and it's kind of a crude concept because many things don't fit that concept because as quantum physics is showing, there's a heck of a lot more subjectivity in the universe than we're thinking.
Okay.
That one's point of view, one's perspective – changes known reality, the twin paradox. One twin's on Earth, one twin's up in a spaceship. Well, Newtonian physics said they should be the same age. But relativity says that one's going to get old and one's going to stay young because he's flying around. Turns out you do – time does move more slowly on a moving object. So things are subject to the viewer and astrology is very much a thing that's subject to the perspective of the viewer.
But see, ultimately, if it's going to be useful, there has to be a resonance between astrology and predictions and pattern matching and the real world. Otherwise, there's no relevance at all.
Well, we can talk about the environment. So one of the important things, and I think the most important things that astrology does is provide a means of describing the environment. The environment under the Obama administration involved structural change. And we saw all kinds of corporate and government restructuring under Obama, radical. I mean, the banking systems of Europe and the United States collapsed. The U.S. banks were recapitalized. We went from
when you say Obama, remember, this all happened under George Bush. It was Obama coming in, Bush leaving,
yes,
and that
yes,
incredible
transition.
Yes. I'm
not blaming Obama for that, but I'm saying
okay, but when you attach a name to it, for a lot of people may not be listening clearly – they may associate you connecting blame with Obama yeah. somehow did this. You're saying that Obama is more like an indicator.
Well,
like
he comes in at the same time – he comes into office at the same time Pluto enters Capricorn.
Okay.
And so it's during the campaign that we have the banking collapse.
Yep.
In the summer of 8. And McCain suspends his campaign, which is hilarious. And suspend your campaign. Just take it with you. I mean, what's to suspend? Take it back to the Capitol. Have the press conference right outside your office like you're supposed to. So synchronous with Obama coming in and Bush going out, we end this era of isms and we begin one of structural adjustment. And that accelerates rapidly as another influence enters the picture, Uranus entering Aries, which happens on the day the Fukushima incident occurred.
March 10th, 2011, I think.
Correct. And there is – that too is a structural change, right? The structure was breached. The containment was breached on three nuclear plants at least, and the whole thing became rickety. There's an image of Pluto in Capricorn now taking an aspect from Uranus.
Well, the amazing thing is Pluto, of course, derives its name from the same root as plutonium.
Yep, and uranium, Uranus and uranium.
Yep.
So
yep.
we begin the era of Uranus square Pluto that day with a lot of uranium and plutonium leaking. So a lot of these structural changes happen, and then the next big act is Arab Spring. And that occurs right at the same time as Fukushima. We forget, right, because they seem so separate. But that Arab Spring happens in spring of 11 with Fukushima burning. And that is a massive call, worldwide call for structural change, particularly in the region of the world with the most oppressive governments.
Mm.
And that doesn't end well. It ends with a lot of tyranny. That's the sad thing of Arab Spring. It begins so beautifully and then it ends with the kind of stuff we're seeing now, and with the, you know, descent into complete war. So,
well, again, it kind of goes back to my mantra in terms of this physics. We're going to get into a discussion of hyperdimensional physics and hyperdimensional astrology. But the kind of watchword of the physics is the good are getting better and the bad are getting worse. When you turn a lot of energy into a system that does not know how to handle it, and I'm probably not using the right words, it's kind of like the Mercury going backwards thing. You're dumping energy in, and what will come out is whatever was predisposed to come out, just a lot more of it. So the Arab Spring released the lid, and an awful lot of very bad stuff has appeared. But it didn't have to. Astrology doesn't say that it had to, does it?
No. But in a sense, astrology predicted the protests going from one country to the other pretty much as fast as the internet could move.
Mm-hmm.
And what became of that's another story. You know, I've been describing this era as the anti-60s because we have all the ingredients of the 1960s, but it's just that things for a while anyway seem to be getting negative. Now, I am fully in accord with you on things are becoming more like they are and more, kind of more like they're not, where there's this extreme bifurcation going on.
The polarization.
Yeah, it only seems to be increasing.
Well, look at the difference between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, yet they're both revolutionaries. They're both outside the system. They're both saying the same things. Well, not most of the same things, but some of the same things. But Trump has taken it to the absolute max where nothing now is socially bound.
Yeah.
And Sanders is trying to take the high road to where he's not even, you know, in terms of contemporary political terminology, he's not even attacking his other, you know, Democratic contenders.
That's his style.
So
it's id versus superego. It's almost like it's – we've got – you know, politics is – egotistical sport, but now we have just the id, to use Freudian psychology, on one side versus the superego on the other side.
It is so naked. Eric, it is such a tableau. And what I've tried to get this audience to understand is when I talk about politics, I'm not talking about conventional, you know, Chris Matthews, hardball kind of politics. I'm looking at the underpinnings of a psychological tapestry, a landscape which is morphed now into something so unusual, so bizarre, so extreme, driven by forces that I believe are better described by astrological terms than by science terms.
Yep. We're experiencing a kind of a meltdown
Yes, that's it. It's basically a meltdown, and every mainstream commentator says, oh, this has never happened before. Like, they get used to it because it's going to get even more interesting.
Right, but there's no – their framework doesn't give them the ability to question or describe what's going on.
No,
They have a problem because they have to serve the role as gatekeepers, right? All these people on MSNBC, they're very nice, but almost all of them are serving the role of left gatekeeper. They say how far to the left you're allowed to go.
Yeah, well, Fox does the same thing on the right, so.
Right, so I consider them to be gatekeepers of their respective gates. And what Bernie is – what they're both doing is they're – first of all, they're expanding that. Bernie is okay to be socialist. That was something Obama was accused
Bernie
of. Now
socialism.
Sanders is claiming
Eric, Bernie socialism is Nixon-Eisenhower republicanism.
Yeah.
Remember, we built the interstate highway system with public money under a general who had been elected after a major world war to run the country as president.
Yes.
We bolstered Social Security. We bolstered the idea of civil rights under Republican administrations.
Yeah,
so
I know.
When Bernie says
– it's so sad.
When Bernie says he's a socialist, it's irrelevant. Socialism now, the lines have so changed – that
yep.
Bernie's socialism is basically, you know, Everett Dirksen, Dwight Eisenhower, republicanism.
Yeah, I jokingly tell people it's kind of true that I voted for Obama in 2008 because he was a good Republican.
Yes!
And one of the most appalling things is people saying he's the most liberal president in history.
Ever,
I just
ever.
Start laughing. It's like uncontrollable. You say that. People say that. They have no concept that this is just the most ridiculous statement ever.
Well, it means that people have lost total contact with references and sources and education and any of the things that we used to. We are now in a free fall. We're in a cultural free fall. So, Eric, I wanted you tonight to try to give us some structure, but from a totally different perspective.
Yeah,
how,
I'm going there.
How does the Obama era archetypally kick us off into this totally unknown place we're going at warp 9?
Okay. So I'm going to tell the story through Pluto and Capricorn squared by Uranus, Arab Spring, the Arab Spring movement, then the Wisconsin protest, the Occupy movement, and Fukushima all happened in 2011. And this sets the tone of the Obama years, the Obama era. And at the end of this era now, the Uranus-Pluto square has peaked. It peaked in 2012. It ended in 2015, this time last year. And it's now being handed off to two new major dominant aspects that will describe the next major era. The first one. So remember, there's a crumbling going on, and there's also uprising, but it's generally not successful uprising. It's a lot of failed revolutions happening. Now the
when you say failed revolutions, name one or two.
Okay, so the Yes We Can revolution of Obama. We're gonna do it. We're gonna solve the country's problems. Turns out, no. We're gonna be a nice, friendly, down-to-earth Republican administration. We're not going to do very much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tons of mass shootings, whatever you believe about them, we're not going to make any changes. It's a lot of – now, with failed revolutions
now,
in Arab Spring
– have you heard what's happened in the last few days, few hours literally?
Well, are you talking about Obama looking
Obama's looking for ways to do executive order gun control because the Congress is not going to cooperate at all. We have 30,000 people killed by guns in this country every year. Like, we're at war, and no one seems to acknowledge that 30,000 people don't have to die that way.
No, it's a civil war, and it's been an ramping up civil war for years, and it's a sensitive subject, and it's kind of an amazing reflection of American life.
It's amazingly interesting how when I get into the subject of gun control, my email goes nuts. I get such extraordinary emails. In fact, the more I want interesting emails, the more I'll just mention, you know. Well, yeah, so
you're
get
feeling
interesting.
Lonely.
Yes, if when I want something to read, I just mention gun control and Obama and Trump. You know, if I particularly come down hard on Trump, I get tons of email. But you're saying that this change, this rolling thunder change now, as we enter this next era, presages what?
two things happen. Instead of the quote-unquote revolution being outwardly directed, for example, Arab Spring, or take over the capital in Madison, the change now pulls internally. It is now about questioning. So we're entering a period of deep questioning. Saturn in Sag squared Neptune in Pisces.
When you say so questioning, you mean questioning of all kinds of basic institutions, like why has my government been lying to me about everything important for the last – well, for my entire life?
That would qualify. That actually that would qualify. But more like, why didn't I see this, or why didn't I believe it?
Oh.
Why I saw the evidence. Why did I deny it? So it's the question is going to be much more inward and philosophical rather than projected outward. This is the thing. It now becomes a kind of an introjection and taking that in where the movement is internal. And then – so that goes on for a while and we're in the thick of it. We've been in – we've been entering it.
When you say for a while, given that we're looking at ephemerids, how long does this go on?
It's a threshold era, first of all. So – example, the aspect associated with the 9/11 incident kind of never ended. It moved on, you know, a year later, but it we're still in it. So the more earnestly we take it, the more it will become a permanent feature of consciousness. And the feature of consciousness is about questioning one's beliefs, and it's about the loss of let's say religious ideology to the underlying spiritual ideology. So one of the most oppressive operating systems humans have been put under has been religion.
Mm-hmm.
And it is after a phase of religion just fucking driving itself crazy through the roof. It's the fundamentalism in all quarters, whether it's Zionist, whether it's fundamentalist Christians, whether it's fundamentalist Islam – is over the top. It's like it's, you know, it's like the Crusades again. And so this now is one of the melting points that it's not going to have the effect that it has had in the past. It's not going to be able to rally people so much on these stupid isms. So that's one thing that happens. Then in a kind of a chain reaction, we have also – involving a fire sign, because Saturn's in a fire sign, Sagittarius. In Aries, there is a conjunction that has been brewing. The last time the cycle came around was the middle of the 1920s.
That's intriguing.
So one thing about Eris is because its orbit is about 550 years.
Now, wait. You have to define Eris. Eris is not familiar
let's go
to
back
most
to
people.
So the conjunction – sorry, it is late at night where I am. I'm not in my absolutely the most coherent thinking in terms of first references. So welcome everyone. First reference to the new planet Eris. In 2005, a planet was discovered by Mike Brown and team, guys who discover a lot of planets.
At Caltech.
Orbiting our sun, Caltech. Team of Caltech, and then Chad Trujillo is up in Hawaii, and then Dave Rabinowitz is like at Harvard or someplace. If he's at Yale, he'll be mad. And it might be Yale, actually. And they've discovered a lot of planets. Turns out the one that got everyone's attention finally was Eris in 2005. And by 2006, they know they've got this thing on their hands. It's about the same size as Pluto, and it's far away, and it's slow. And cold out there, but the thing is very bright and it looks very large, and they've got a problem on their hands, which is that their known categories of planets don't work. So they all meet in Prague in 2006, and they have a meeting on what to do about this, and they demote Pluto and they elevate Ceres, the first asteroid, to a dwarf planet, and then Eris is also categorized a dwarf planet. So now we've got this new planet that's kind of not only been discovered like lots of things before it, but forced astronomy to reorder itself. So Eris is also a subverter of the known order. This is the beauty of Eris. And Uranus, the planet that is the one that came with the Fukushima incident on the day that it changed signs, which it does every 7 years, is also a subverter of the known order responsible for many revolutions, or at least synchronous with many revolutions throughout history.
Mm.
Now Eris and Uranus are getting together in Aries for the first time since 1925. That's when this conjunction happened, when Eris, which spends more than 120 years in Aries because of the shape of its orbit, it gets two conjunctions from Uranus, who has an 84-year orbit. So just when Eris arrived in Aries, it took a conjunction from Uranus, and now 84 years, 80-ish years later, it's taking another conjunction from Uranus.
Now, can we analyze what could happen in terms of analogs with the 1920s?
Well, that's one way to look at it. I mean, you know, it was an exciting time.
One to say, Prohibition...
Well, but it was also the era of the flapper and of speakeasy. So there's prohibition going on, but there's some great hash bars. Kind of like now. So you can have a good time, you know, as long as you pay it off the mob to have liquor in your establishment. And, you know, leading to a collapse.
But there was also women's suffrage.
Yes.
See, I'm looking at major social trends here.
One of the social trends associated with Eris is women's suffrage. Women's rights is associated with Eris. For example, in the 70s, during
women,
the peak,
women predominantly are somehow a major part of the coming election. I'll tell you what, hold it there. We're at the top of the hour. My guest this morning is Eric Francis Coppolino, actually. And we're discussing astrology. We're discussing astrology in terms of psychological impact. We're looking at major trends. We talked about Obama and the transition between the Bush years and the Obama years and transitions. We're coming up to another one now, 2016, literally a year from now, another election, and the first time that seriously a woman has a chance, maybe, to be president. You're on the other side of Midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We'll be back with Eric Francis shortly. We shall return. Don't go away. And we are back with my guest this morning, Eric Francis. Eric, we were discussing the Obama years, and I think you said something to the effect that it's nice to be in a place where people don't hate Obama. Obama was a nice middle-of-the-road Republican.
Yes.
That's what's so astonishing about all the hate directed and all the cries of socialism and communists and all that nonsense, because my grandmother and my grandfather used to have pictures flanking the fireplace of, you know, on these oval pieces of redwood that someone had laboriously painted. On the left side of the fireplace was the president, Dwight Eisenhower. On the right side was Richard Nixon, and they were Republicans. My father was a Republican. My mother was a Republican.
Yeah.
And when I talk about Obama in favorable terms, because there are a lot of interesting things he's doing that aren't getting any attention at all that will live in history as positive, people look at me like I've come down from Mars, because they don't recognize how far our politics have shifted to where someone who is sane and reasonable and thinking and tries to bring folks together can be viewed as a radical, whereas someone who is basically playing totally to people's fears and the worst potential of the human condition, i.e. Trump, can be viewed as some kind of a radical.
Yeah. Look, all these definitions have lost their meaning. All the concepts of Republicanism and Democratism and liberal and conservative and you know, even the concept radical has lost it. These things don't have their bywords, basically. We don't know what they mean. They're like a street corner that's so heavily trodden that no one knows what the heck the word means.
And does the astrology support what the physics analysis that we've been trying to do supports, which is we're in an incredible time of transition from what was to what is, but we're in the middle now where nothing stands still.
Massive transitional era right now. Because Pluto in Capricorn is just half over, and things are just beginning.
So we have decades left.
Well, we do. We have another 8 years of Pluto in Capricorn, and a lot of activity in Pisces is saying we need to actually get spiritual. We need to subject our ideas not to a religious test or a scientific test, but to a test of empathy and of existence.
And is there anybody in the public arena doing anything even approaching that?
Sanders.
That's the only one.
I think. I don't hear anything kind coming out of the mouth of any other candidate. They're all against everything, including each other and the human race. And you have Sanders basically saying we must take care of each other. We must stop this unfairness and we must take care of each other. Like Obama, it seems radical. But the amazing thing is people are resonating with it. People are really resonating with what he's saying.
See, what's so interesting to me about the Trump phenomenon is that we now really have almost like a psychological or political CAT scan of the body politic. We now know that between 30 to 40% of the rock-ribbed people who identify themselves as Republicans are going to vote for Trump. Now, that 40% translates in terms of the general electorate to something on the order of maybe, 8 or 9%?
The country is evenly split, right? It's evenly split Dem, Pub, and Independent, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we're talking 15%, right? If it's – no, how much? A third of the rock-rib Republicans mm-hmm. are going to vote mm-hmm. for him? Mm-hmm. So that's 10%.
Yeah, roughly. Okay.
So the disturbing thing is the media echo chamber makes this look bigger than it is.
See, that's what's so interesting, because what we're doing is we're identifying that 30% of people who basically want to get rid of the First Amendment, who want to adore the Second Amendment, who basically are fearful and terrified of anybody who's not like them, who doesn't look like them, act like them, talk like them, vote like them, think like them. But the good news is it's only 10% of 90% of the country.
Yep.
And that is important to know, that at this critical time of transition, we've got 10% who are crazy and 90% who are going to keep us from going to hell in a handbasket.
The only problem is that ideas are contagious, and there are conditions under which these ideas, which are like fire, thrive. One of them is
under fear.
Poverty.
If incredibly bad happened, if, as Trump has said several times, and I've noted carefully, we're going to have another 9/11, we're going to have another 9/11. In an era of strongmen, go back to the 30s and the 20s when the whole Nazi thing was starting astrologically. Do you see a pattern here and now with what was forming, that awful stuff forming in Germany in that time frame?
I do, but I'm reluctant to use it strictly as a means of prediction, because often different things happen. So you'll have similar conditions, but never the same conditions, mm-hmm. and then different things happen. So it is certainly.
Well, lay out the parallels without. We're obviously not locked into recapitulating history over and over and over again, otherwise nothing would ever change. But what are the parallels that are producing, as I see, from a non-astrological point of view, a very similar psychology and cultural medium in which the dark forces that created the Nazi era are out there, and they're swirling around and they're looking for a way to get a second chance?
Remember, they're different. Okay, they're not different in that really we're talking about fascism as the merger of a right-wing government and corporate power. Mm-hmm. This is the problem. This is the kind of cancerous element. But I'm looking at a chart for Feb 33, right around comes into office, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's also the end of the Prohibition era. And what do we have? I mean, the thing with that era was more Aquarius, though it was kind of quick moving, a lot of Aries. So this is the biggest parallel is an era involving Aries where there is a hot-headed, do it for appearance and a lot of me, me, me thinking, which is what the Nazis were all about. Mm. Their subtle shtick was, you know, don't worry about the bigger picture. Just worry about your own skin. Worry about yourself. Don't leave the hard stuff to us experts. And it's also the Pluto opposition of the Nazi era. So Pluto has gone halfway around the zodiac, and it is about to encounter its opposition point. I count that as, if not good news, a moment of reflection. That opposition is like a reflection. And it can show – we can look back and decide if that's what we want. Now, the problem with the way that politics is waged now, as it was in that era, for example, the Nazi era really is consolidated by the Reichstag fire, which is the scariest chart that I've ever seen. And 9/11.
Well, when you say a chart, you mean you actually did a chart, an astrological chart, where all the planets and the sun and the moon and everything in the sky is relative to each other on a celestial plot. You did it for the Reichstag fire, and you found.
Well, it's just I don't have the chart in front of me, but you can do charts for mundane events, and it reeks of the this was done. Everybody knows that fire was set and blamed on a communist. And the same kind of incident begins the 9/11 era. The 21st century begins with this, I think, blatantly false flag event of 9/11. Impossible. You have to really have your eyes closed to not see that. And you can inflame people. And so if there's a nuclear incident, for example, the only 9/11 that's going to shock us now is a nuclear bomb in an American city. So we better not have that. Because the only thing that could top three World Trade Center towers collapsing, although most people think it was two, and the Pentagon getting
building,
hit by
building some, seven came down.
Yeah, I know, but that's not well known. That's why the judge said building what, and the people said the attorney building seven. Never heard of it. So it shows that the shock doctrine works. Another interesting thing out of the 1920s was the when does War of the Worlds incident happens in the early 30s, right?
No.
Hold on. Let me get that chart up. Hold on.
Orson Welles did it in 1938.
Okay, hold on. I apologize for getting that wrong. It's a lot of – usually I have my charts prepared, but let me look at that graphic.
It was Halloween of 38.
Yeah. So that told us a lot. So the shock doctrine, as Naomi Klein calls it, where they burn the Reichstag or take out the World Trade Center, the only parallel thing now is a nuclear bomb. That's the only thing that could, as far as I can tell, that could get anyone's – and so therefore we need to not go down that road.
Well, it wouldn't even have to be a nuclear bomb. It could just be what's called a dirty bomb, which is basically a bunch of radioactive materials spread around by a chemical explosion, you know, C4 or something.
Not nuclear enough for you? That's nuclear enough for
me? Well, but no, because a nuclear weapon is a total many orders of magnitude, like six orders of magnitude worse. So something which scares the bejesus out of people but intrinsically is frankly not very dangerous, which a dirty bomb would be unless you're right in the vicinity and get hit by the shrapnel. A dirty bomb, given the availability of the isotopes, would be messy and would scare people to hell and gone, but it would not be intrinsically lethal because the radioactives that are available are just not very, very, very deadly.
Okay.
But the psychology of it would be overwhelming.
Terrible. Right. It would be
San Bernardino on steroids. So yes,
right, but
that's,
not the mushroom cloud.
No, but see, that's the event. It's more symbolic than substantive, because remember, in a country where we kill 30,000 people a year,
with guns,
with guns. The fact that 14 people died in San Bernardino, I mean, 14 people out of 30,000, it's like, but it's how they died.
It's the way it's focused into a plot in by the production company CNN, which makes it into the live action movie happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody really cares that. I mean, they're you know, we're seeing the videos of the guy getting chased through the park by the cop trying to shoot him. I mean, those are but what do you expect now in a TV driven culture where the cops are now going to all have video cameras, where everybody has a video camera? I mean, that's amazing that, you know, video cameras were kind of a rare commodity even in the 1990s. Now every single person has one in their pocket. It's ridiculous.
Actually, some of them have two or three.
Yeah, sure, especially if they're pot
so,
dealers.
So back to astrology and trends. What can astrology tell us about this transition era? A, how long it's going to be, roughly. B, what the high points will be. In other words, are there game changers buried in this transition that will totally give us the mechanisms to alter our trajectory, or are we kind of impelled to go in the direction we're headed, which is not a good direction?
Okay, so here's how it is. Right? We're being given the tools. The main tools are Pluto and Capricorn facilitating structural change. What do we do with it? Second, Saturn, the lord of structure, the planet associated with structure, and Sag, Aterius, belief, making a square to Neptune. We have the ability to dissolve belief. So we've got structure that is now open to change and well prepared. We have belief that is open to being given up, and other factors are heavily describing the belief thing. And then finally we have the Uranus-Eris conjunction in Aries, the ability to radically redefine ourselves. Now, we're given the tools. They're sharp, hot objects. We're given the workshop. The gas is running. It is a dangerous laboratory where anything can happen. What do we do with that social laboratory? Here's where we have to basically place our bets on the ability of people to influence consciousness. For people who have a positive message to, you know, basically offer that as a kind of a meme that picks up. And the good getting better, worse getting worse thing is a little bit like the scenario in The Stand by Stephen King, which was now seeming quite prescient, where the good people are all drawn to Denver and the evil people are all drawn to Vegas or something. But he does it in that novel.
Mm-hmm.
And they dream of the guy, you know, all the bad people dream of the dude, the walking dude, and the good people dream of the old black lady sitting in a rocking chair. Then there is a kind of a standoff for the control of consciousness. Now, the thing is this. We may need to just choose our level of consciousness and not worry so much about what the other people are thinking and just do the thing that we need to do. For example, if we're going to work on climate change, we have to at a certain point stop listening to climate change deniers and just simply do the work that we need to do. And do the – which is conservation, which is making decisions, which is making structural changes in society. But we have the astrology clearly points to a continuing process of structural change and a relatively new process of questioning beliefs. This is a really positive the most welcome element in a long time is the ability to question presuppositions, especially religious ones.
This is one of the most interesting things about Trump, because even though he has created or enunciated positions that are absolutely outrageous, the fact that he's bringing up all this stuff makes him the foil for people who wouldn't think of it on their own. But now that he has voiced it, now that he's talked about it, it becomes part of the discussion, and people can either like it or not like it or be offended by it or reject it. So, I mean, he is this incredible foil. It's almost like this era needed a Trump figure, because it has to be an individual that people can rally around or polarize around in terms of the outrageous things he is saying, which are upsetting all kinds of structure.
Yeah, and he's venting spleen. He's giving a voice to anger, which is a very important thing, for example, in a therapeutic process. So if he's spewing all this vitriolic, you know, BS, basically. He is actually speaking for people's unconscious. There's a lot of people who do think like him, and they find that kind of tough talk satisfying.
Well, I think the numbers are much higher than 10%. I think there's an awful lot of independents and Democrats that if push came to shove, they would vote for Trump just because it's like, what more can go wrong? Maybe it can be made to go right if we really throw the baby over the cliff.
He's going to hate being president, though. He doesn't realize it's like being in a prison cell where they, like, measure your toilet paper when you're done with it, where they, you know, seriously, where they, like, you know, the Secret Service brought a porta-potty to China for Bush so they could keep his poo so the Chinese couldn't analyze it. So you think, do you really think that a guy like Trump is going to want someone saving his poo and there's nothing he can do about it?
Do you remember way back, you know, like about 19 and a half months into the Obama administration, Obama suddenly decides to remodel the Oval Office. Remember how, because of the financial crisis...
Oh, he left the Bush look?
For the first 19 and a half months. Now, 19 and a half is really important. This audience knows what 19.5 means. 19.5
That's latitude, right?
Ultimately, it goes back to a latitude.
Where the pyramids are.
But not those pyramids. It's the latitude on planets and stars where energy erupts.
Ah, there's a concentration.
This hyperdimensional nexus of energy, and it comes up at the 19.5 points. The fact is that if you want to communicate to someone about hyperdimensional physics or torsion field physics, you just couch it in some of these symbolic indicators like 19.5, and your audience will know what you're talking about if they are familiar with those terms. So 19 and a half months into his administration, after saying he's not going to spend taxpayer money because we can't afford it, suddenly the Obama administration remodels with private money donations the Oval Office. And some friends of mine and I took a very careful look at all of the accoutrements, all of the, you know, lamps and rugs and pillows and everything. And basically what Obama did was to remodel the Oval Office so it reflects that of a 21st century prison cell. If you look at the wallpaper, Eric, those are bars. Obama's communicating the presidency is basically a prisoner, and he's done under those limits. Well, Obama's administration from the get-go has been symbolic from the moment that he took the oath of office for the second time. Remember how the head of the Supreme Court, the Justice
John Roberts,
had to come back,
which is an indicator. Remember, I said there were two ways to read the Obama administration. One is the long sweeping trends of history, which we've been doing. The other is the things like that happened, and I call it the void of course presidency.
Well, hang on. So what John Roberts did is he came back to the White House the next night. Not at noon in the afternoon, which would have been 24 hours later, which would have mirrored the actual oath-taking. But he came back at night, delivered the oath to Obama by himself with only Pete Souza, who was the White House photographer, there to take a picture. He took it in a special room in the White House. I don't remember which room it was. But they rearranged the pictures on the wall to reflect symbolically what that room represented. And, Eric, it was done exactly at 7:30 Eastern time, which is 19.5 military time.
In D.C.,
with Orion right over the Washington Monument as seen from the window of that room, where Obama looked out the window at the Washington Monument as Roberts stood in front of him and delivered the oath. So I've been looking at Obama and his election from a hyperdimensional astrological point of view for a very long period of time. And yes, there are some remarkable things about his administration, which I think has not yet been fulfilled. I think the next year is going to totally surprise an awful lot of people who think that Obama is just going to quietly fade into the vast background of history.
No, it's not possible. I mean, the things that – first of all, I don't think he will. But I think also that, yes, he may be saving his best moves for the end of the game. And I, you know, I really hope he's healthy and safe through the whole thing.
Well, you know, they've been constantly testing the Secret Service from day one, don't you? Do you remember?
I mean, there have been repeated breaches. I mean, it's
do you remember
testing them every way?
Hang on. Do you remember Obama's first state dinner?
What happened?
Went back. This goes back, you know, 8 years, something like that. It was the Prime Minister of India. Remember in Washington, and they built this whole long, glittering, you know, tent-like structure
out on the lawn.
And you could see the obelisk of the Washington Monument, and it looked pyramidal, and it was all very symbolic. Anyway, that was the first state dinner, and that's when the so-called party crashers appeared. Remember this couple from Virginia?
Yeah, that was a great story.
Who got all the way up to and into the White House, and the Secret Service was fit to be tied because they got far beyond where they should have been stopped, and all the checkpoints, you know, didn't work, and the interleaving, you know, facilities within the agency, the cross-checks and controls all fell apart, and these guys wound up getting next to the president without any clearances at all. Remember that, all that?
Yeah,
turns
vividly.
Turns out I have a photograph of those three people together in the same room in Chicago. The party crashers were Obama's way of testing his own Secret Service.
That's exciting.
And there have been other tests. I mean, I've made a study of watching this guy because hyperdimensionally, in terms of the physics, Obama's presidency is supposed to make a difference. And it hasn't yet, but I think it's about to. And that's why I wanted to ask you, what does the astrology, the mainstream astrology, say when it looks at the same data?
Which data exactly?
The Obama presidency.
Well, there's a lot of ways to look at it, but because there's a lot of data, but the Obama era ends on a radically different note than it began on, and so there is a radical we're in a transitional era, definitely between these long eras of history, and I'm surprised there hasn't been more change. That's the thing. So we may yet see that. You know, what are we really coming out of the Obama – what change are we really coming out of the Obama administration with? We're coming out with same-sex marriage, which I think is huge, because 50 years ago, same-sex people were morally and medically abominations, and now they are sanctified by the Supreme Court – with a fundamental right. It's a rarefied category of rights. And I think this is going to open the way to the freedom to actually love. And that is essential to choosing destiny. The personal is much more influential here than we may think. And the other thing is, we begin the administration with cannabis legalization being unthinkable, and we end it with multiple states having recreational and the majority of states having medical, and Justin Trudeau is going to put through recreational, and all those prohibition states are going to be surrounded. Basically, we're seeing the end of prohibition, and the end of cannabis prohibition it allows a vast new array of medicines to challenge these bad pharmacology medicines, and also
bad. They're killing people.
Terrible. They're terrible. And you can, if you have seizure disorders, there's numerous things that medical cannabis, whichever components you use, is a whole variety of things. And the second thing is, my theory of why cannabis is illegal, mainly, it makes people horny. They want to be frisky and creative and have sex.
Okay.
Now, you might think, oh, that's really off the wall. But the truth is, it's not that off the wall. Smoke a little pot and how do you feel? And now we're seeing this era of prohibition of a dimension of consciousness. The bizarre thing about prohibiting a substance is you're prohibiting a dimension of consciousness. And cannabis is
this is so important. Let's pick this up after the bottom of the hour.
We'll go right from here.
Yep. My guest this morning is Eric Francis Coppolino. We're discussing astrology, and we've just gotten into something which is really intriguing to me, which is the consciousness of some of the major Obama moves as we prepare for this new era, this transition now, the other half of the Pluto-Capricorn conjunction. Anyway, you're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we are indeed masters of our own destiny. We shall return. And we are back on the other side of midnight. Yeah, Eric, I want to pick up on that point because to me, the most intriguing thing that the Obama administration has done, and you're telling me that the astrology kind of maps this out, it has laid the foundation for a stunning fundamental change in consciousness just at a time when the physics and the astrology says that structural change is now the order of the day.
Yeah, structural change in parallel with the relatively newer questioning of belief.
Mm.
One of the problems we have is that belief puts a lock on consciousness. And you don't believe something, so therefore it's not available. And this is the real problem, I think, in consciousness, is beliefs dominating. And now beliefs are coming under tough times. It's not as easy for a belief to hold up. And it's one of the reasons why we see more polarization, because people are trying to cling to beliefs that don't work anymore. So there's going to be this sort of inward struggle of belief paralleled by more structural change and collapse in the world. And then we get this moment of what I would call quickening that we're in. So going back to the last subject, the two major changes of consciousness that come out of the Obama years, not Obama per se, but he was supportive in some of this, is that his administration has been pretty mean to pot people, but it's not stopping the referenda from coming through. So for whatever reason, people realize this is stupid to ban this and to have gin be legal at the same time. And so we're getting this whatever dimension, which I think has a lot to do with sex, the cannabis dimension opens up. This dimension where the imagination is enhanced is now being legitimized, and same-sex relationships are being legitimized, which take a huge taboo and throw it into the fire.
Absolutely.
And even if you're heterosexual, the liberation of same-sex people, same-sex pairers, liberates heterosexual people as well, because it releases a huge, needless, negative taboo. Now, one of the other things that came in under Obama was the smartphone. Again, the Obama years, like he didn't legislate the iPhone. That was Steve Jobs. But the smartphone comes in as a huge element of these years. And it's one of the things that is another structural meltdown. And what people have done is, thanks to these devices, have even more taken their relationships into the online world, to the point where many people don't know how to have a conversation anymore.
Hmm.
And that's kind of scary.
Have you noticed people go to dinner and they sit there and they tap?
This is the thing.
There are four people sitting at a table and the waiter comes up. And the waiter is afraid to interrupt because they're all looking at their screens and they're all using their little styluses and they're all making little tiny, tiny, tiny tick marks on those screens.
Yeah.
And they could be anywhere. I mean, the reason the show exists is because of this technology, which means someone in Bangkok, someone in Timbuktu, someone in Moscow – I know this because they sent me an email the other night – found this show on their device because they were bored and they didn't want to look at a sanitized Russian version of CNN.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So it too is two-edged. But the phone bit has really made the whole technology extremely personal.
And now, portable. It can be with you anywhere 24/7.
That's the personal part. You're always on the network. You're never not on the network. Okay. At what point does that implode? And there's the implication of that imploding.
How?
Because eventually, and it's happening places and people realize it's not satisfying, that we're in our bodies. We have plenty of time to be discarnated spirits. Once we've left our bodies, now we're here in physical form, and I'm seeing a counter-revolution against this what ultimately has served to be a personally alienating technology. For media types like you and me, it's fantastic. We get to
this audience. I don't know how you and I – you're a writer obviously, so you do the same thing I do. Writing now is so much different than it used to be when you had to physically go to a library. And, of course, the library next door at the university where you live was not the right library. So you had to get into library loans and everything took 10 times longer. And
you drive to the Capitol to pull the collection
exactly.
there.
Exactly. Yes, yes.
So now it's awesome if you're an academic, if you're into research. The whole concept of Googling it is awesome, though it's – the superficiality factor has gone up with the small size screen – and everything being read on the go, right? So I personally can't do any of that work from a little teeny screen. I just sit in my 27-inch monitor and look at things and take notes, right? And I always have a pencil in my hand. Okay, but personally, these devices have infested the personal realm and driven people apart from each other, I think. But that is, I think, going to backlash and in a positive way and – lead to a kind of a collective awakening.
How so?
Because that tends to be what happens when things go to an extreme. That
You mean we're all going to throw our devices in the trash and this show?
No,
suddenly?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I'm predicting potluck dinners. I mean, I'm not exactly predicting it, but I'm saying the thing we need to do is we need to get together in communities, small local communities.
Hmm. Or communities that can be organized. Remember the old flash mob thing with social media where you can organize a physical get-together. In fact, I've got some ideas along this line for later this year. I might be rolling out some experiments on that. But the idea is you use the medium to physically get people all together so they can basically have a party.
Yeah.
So they can physically get to know each other. And then, of course, they can keep in touch anywhere on the planet.
Yes. Yeah, which does work. I mean, the Arab Spring was a function of smartphones.
Yeah.
Twitter. I mean, this is very useful. And then these local networks that were being set up, these like, you know, to subvert surveillance. I forget the name of it. The name of the thing that was used, I think, in Hong Kong. We have to take control of this technology, all of it, before it fully defines us as robots.
Hmm.
Because the thing is, you become like the technology that you use, and the internet is the first fully robotic technology. And so we've been associating with each other through, and are right now, through a robot, and people have been conducting their romantic and sexual relationships through a robot, and we're becoming more and more robotic. The question is, when does that kind of reach the melting point?
In other words, when will it transition to the next phase?
Cannabis may help.
Hmm, interesting.
Because it instills the craving for real experience, but it's also very good at fantasy. So again, everything is double-edged. Everything is could go either way. And the astrology of this – excuse me, I'm hiccuping – post-2012 era. I think the 2012 era goes from like about 08 to 15 – and now we're in the post-2012 era, and we now get another choice to make. We get to look another way at everything, and the bifurcation thing is a real thing. We can go hyperbolically toward everyone having – like the episode of South Park a few weeks ago where every man, woman, and child in town is armed. Or we can realize that there is something to peace and love after all, and we really just want to get along with each other. And all these people we've been convinced are evil are not. But the shock doctrine is a real thing.
And what does what does the astrological meta picture say in terms of trends? Where are we going?
It doesn't point to the outcome. The trend is bad. That's the thing. An astrologer would be lying if they were to point to the outcome. Let's stick to the question and describe the environment. The environment is one of structural collapse, beliefs being questioned, and personal redefinition of selfhood.
So in an era where things were institutions and things we've trusted outside ourselves are collapsing, what's the human tendency to try to do? Is try to cling to something to believe in, is try to create either new structure or to reinforce parts of the old structure that are the most durable. Again, where do the trend curves seem to be taking us?
Well, look on the ground. I mean, I think one response is farmers markets, right? So this is being taken for granted. There's a farmers market in every town in my community. There's one in Woodstock. There's one in New Paltz, Rosendale, Kingston, Saugerties. There's farmers markets everywhere.
We have three here in Albuquerque.
This is new. This is not – how long? How many? 20 years? How far does it go back, right? Not even. So when the large structures collapse, people do what they always do. They get together and trade.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to be doing more of that getting together and trading. We're seeing a lot more artisanal crafts happening. I like to hang out with the Marshall McLuhan crowd, and there's someone who's come up with the kind of maxim, digital retrieves medieval. And so we're seeing a lot of medieval retrieval going on in terms of candle making, butchering, handmade fabrics, farmers markets, farming itself, beekeeping, practices that have been around for hundreds and hundreds of years, much longer, are now coming back into fashion. And so while on the one trend, everything's moving toward mega size things and banks without branches where you can just do all your banking online, it's completely abstract, there's no manager to talk to and so forth, no teller counter, et cetera, to things being on the ground and in physical, tangible form. And I think we'll see more of that bifurcation. So just the choice really comes down to an individual choice of what you want. I mean, do you really want to go have pizza at Papa John's, or do you want to go to like an actual pizzeria and have actual pizza made by a person you know?
I'm just trying to see how the internet social thing that we currently have going, where everybody is so obsessed to monopolize. I mean, I know people that can't leave home without their phones. If they're halfway to somewhere and they find they left their phone at home, they turn around. They cannot be without their phone. So how do we go from that era of technological dependence on something to where we basically use it as the tool it should be, but we actually interact with people again the way people should interact?
Well, it would be a decision, right? It would be a choice. It's a choice to, you know, take the conversation offline, and it's risky. This is the thing, because you're going off script. You no longer have that little gadget. Everything is now no longer a three-word communique. The conversation has to go on for longer. What we're doing here is completely erudite, maintaining a conversation for 2 hours. We're like some scene out of The Lord of the Rings, Gandalf talking to Galadriel. And hey, no one understands what they're saying.
And we do it with pictures. If we go to othersideofmidnight.com and we go to the upper right-hand corner of Radio with Pictures, click on that. That takes you to tonight's guest page. Eric has provided us with some interesting graphics. Why don't you take us through the graphics? I think
yeah,
we started.
Hold on. Let me navigate to that page. Hold on.
Okay.
It's the other.
Other no no just other side other, of midnight.com.
Good.
Yeah, the other side got very confusing because there apparently is a novelist.
Yep.
And et cetera,
yeah, so Sidney Sheldon or something.
Exactly. Yes. Everybody knows it. Everybody knows it. So othersideofmidnight.com, go to the upper right.
Radio with Pictures.
Click on that.
And all right. So we didn't talk much about the corporate fraud thing.
No.
But let me just say let me give a quick overview of what's here. First of all, the first image does this get archived with my show?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So the first image is artist conception of Eris, beautiful illustration of Eris, the planet that was discovered in 05, named in 06, and kind of made astronomers rearrange the solar system. The crudely hand-drawn graphic is a document out of the files of Monsanto Chemical Corporation, which we haven't had a chance to talk to.
Which document are we talking about? Which link?
The one with the lines, the curves.
What
the
number?
Curves.
What number?
Four.
Number four. Oh,
no,
okay.
Sorry. No, it's not numbered. It doesn't get a number. It's missing one. It's the second item down under Eris.
The second item under Eris. Maybe I'm missing.
Maybe we'll refresh the page.
Yeah, there we go.
Pages have to appear the same, right? I see radio with pictures, and then I see the planet.
Mm-hmm. But I don't see anything after Eris.
Oops.
I see charts for alleged moon landing in 69 is the next one.
Oh, okay. So there, you have it. Maybe refresh your page. You might have a document missing. So anyway, skipping to that, one of the things I track is NASA charts. And sometime I would love to do a show with you, if you'd like, on the astrology of NASA and what that says about whether this stuff is true or not.
Oh, that's an interesting idea.
So I just sent over, just because I chart set on the Apollo 11 mission.
Okay.
And the funny thing about that group is I'm now hip to the issues with the moon landing. I didn't have a good enough reason to doubt it. Then a friend just explained it to me over a few days, and showed me some resources. And I thought, it occurred to me, this really now has moved into the question category. This is no longer a category of certainty. But part of the problem is the charts look good, and they're not the final arbiter. But it does look like they say what it was. But
That we went to the moon, landed, and did everything that it said.
Yeah, but other things don't say that. There's a lot of other problems, like how they got their cameras to work and why the dust settled so quickly. Okay, so
we can have a fun time discussing the physics, because all of the physical questions that have been raised by all the so-called moon hoax crowd have easy and obvious answers, but you have to think in terms of outer space. You can't think in terms of terrestrial analogs.
Yeah, I would love to talk about that.
Okay.
Okay, the next piece down is the Mountain Astrologer. That's actually a PDF of a full article.
Okay, this is the one on Monsanto?
Yeah, it's the one on the astrology of Monsanto. But one of the cool things about that piece is that I spend the first
1500... Those are two terms I would never think would go together, astrology and Monsanto. How do they fit together?
Well, we have the chart from Monsanto's PR piece called Faith, Hope, and $5,000. They talked about what day Edgar Queeny, the founder, went and founded his company. And then I worked with two astrologers, Lawrence Eli and Ursula Fugger, and we independently did a process called rectification. So I worked independently, as double-blind as I could get, with two different old-time classical astrologers, and we both came up with Aquarius rising. And we determined as best we could, using the paradigm of astrology, that the chart for Monsanto was an electional chart, because Queeny was a Freemason. He was the Order of the Knights of Malta, I think. And that they would have been hip to astrology in the early 1900s. And unlike, I think, a lot of corporate bosses today who wouldn't touch the stuff, they did create the Monsanto chart as an electional. And it, whether you have the time or not, it perfectly describes a company that stitches itself into the fabric of government and regulation, and basically is the company that became the government.
Interesting.
And so that's in there, and it's a fun read. The next down is a ebook called Lightbridge.
So you go back to Radio with Pictures, go down to link number 7.
Well, that's the wrong caption. We have to fix those. We'll sort out those captions.
Okay.
But so the Lightbridge book is a compilation.
I don't see a Lightbridge book.
Oops.
Oh, there we are. There we are. Yeah. Yeah, there it is.
Yeah, it's the red and green book cover.
Yep.
And it's a compilation of articles leading into 2012. So it goes – it's a kind of a journal of my writing compiled from the Harmonic Convergence of August 1987. Which began what was being called at the time the 25-year span, 2-12-21-12. And so I chronicle the astrology and the consciousness evolution through most of that 25-year span. It was published before 2012, so it doesn't take it all the way through the Newtown incident, which is what we got on 12/21/12. Next piece down, Beyond the Veil, another article from the Mountain Astrologer, which gives the history of the minor planets. If you're wondering how we went from my very educated mother just showed us nine planets to the current situation today of more than a million objects cataloged orbiting our sun, vast asteroid belt, vast Kuiper belt, scattered disks.
Which is the second asteroid belt out beyond Pluto.
Yeah, it's the one that Pluto's in, actually. Pluto is the current king of an asteroid belt. Then there's a further belt with objects like Sedna and Eris in it called the scattered disk. And all that, how do you handle that as an astrologer? How do you think in terms of that? How do you read all that? That's what the article Beyond the Veil covers, and there's lots in there on Eris, this newly discovered planet. It begins with an Eris story.
And where do you make the dividing line? Because if you've got a million objects and you've got small objects 1,500 miles across like Pluto and Eris, and then you've got Sedna, which is, what, 800 or 900 miles, and you've got a bunch of the other ones, where do you draw the line? I mean, it's almost like the IAU where they politically demoted planets because they didn't want a million planets each with a name. You've got a million objects, each which you're saying in the model has an influence on human consciousness.
Right. So
how can you track that? How can you tools possibly and techniques. Differentiate that?
You need to reduce your data down. You use techniques to reduce the data, and you choose a set. You don't read every point for every chart. You use a set. And one of the ways you reduce the set is mathematically. So let's say we're reading the chart for the inauguration on 1/20/17. Right? The sun is in the first degree of Aquarius on that day. So the first thing I would do is I would look at everything either square, conjunct, or opposite the sun within about 2 degrees. I would narrow down a set of planets that begins with 120 or so that I typically use down to a set of about 10.
These are objects orbiting the sun.
Yeah.
Including 10, planets that we're familiar with. And objects that were not.
Right. Things like Icarus. Things like Damocles.
Eros?
Eros is an important one. It's a near-Earth asteroid. It has about a one-year orbit. It's a kind of fun irony that Eros is the my clock of the Earth. It describes people's anxiety about Eros. It's an asteroid that might hit us, or an arrow. And you reduce your data set down. It comes from experience.
By the way, are you familiar with the fact that NASA did a whole Valentine's Day thing with Eros and the mission that wound up orbiting it?
Yeah, I caught that. Very cute.
Very cute, yes.
They're not astrologers, but they act like it sometimes.
They act like it all the time. Eric, if I went through all of the launches and landings and flybys, the alignment data is stunning. NASA is an astrological agency masquerading as a left-brain scientific agency, as we have deconstructed a million times with landings and launches and this latest mission to Pluto. You know that in July of 1965, NASA sent its first unmanned spacecraft to Mars called Mariner 4, right?
Yes.
Exactly. To the almost hour, 50 years later, NASA sends another spacecraft called New Horizons to Pluto.
Yep.
Half a century, exactly half a century apart. Exactly.
Yeah, they love that. They love anniversaries. And then freaky things happen. Like the only time we've ever lost astronauts, this has been either in very late January or very early February. No one knows why that is. There have been three known incidents where astronauts lost their lives. They spanned from 128 Challenger to around February 4th, I think, which was maybe Apollo 1. And then there's one of them in between on the 2nd, I think. That was
Columbia. So why do you think they all cluster in that time period?
Can't figure it out.
Okay.
It's one of those things. With astrology, you face a lot of mysteries. So you better be patient and ready to wait 10 or 20 years to contemplate something for 10 or 20 years.
Everything you have done in astrology has been basically empirical. In other words,
Not keeping numerical data.
No. But when I say, see, we're having a problem with the definition.
Tell me what you mean by empirical.
Empirical simply means you track the history of it. You don't have a theory. You're just looking at data. You don't have an overarching scenario.
To track why astrology works.
But to do that, you have to go through the doorway of, does it work? How does it work?
Yes.
How replicable is it? Does it work? So I've been looking from the opposite end. The theoretical, which is how could astrology work? Because I remember Sagan saying so proudly to me one day, well, you know, Dick, the gravitational field of the obstetrician is thousands of times bigger than Jupiter, like gravity was supposed to be the mediating influence.
Yeah, and that's not true either.
Well, because whatever the number is.
The obstetrician doesn't pull the sun out of its orbit, but Jupiter does.
Slightly.
Yeah, it wobbles. Okay. It's a big thing.
So anyway, the point is,
does the obstetrician make the sun wobble?
The point is that I've been looking, and obviously we're not going to finish this morning, so we'll do this. We'll pick this up when you come back. But I've been looking at a model, a meta model, of the hyperdimensional torsion field physics as explaining the otherwise inexplicable influences of astrology, because both systems ultimately come down to the geometric pattern of rotating objects in this system called planets and moons and satellites and other things in orbit, and it's the interference pattern in the field that then resonates in certain ways with human beings, with biology and with consciousness that create in this model the effects. And as the first link we have up tonight on our work in the in Radio with Pictures, if you look at link number 2, it's the hyperdimensional eclipse that we measured here in Albuquerque a couple, 3 years ago, and the readings are absolutely astonishing, absolutely astonishing. We now can measure the effect of alignments of celestial bodies on human beings. Anyway, Eric Francis has been my guest this morning. That's our end music. So another 2 hours has suddenly vanished into the ether. I really want to thank you for being my guest. We will have you back. We've only scratched the surface. So until tomorrow morning.
Anytime. It was easier to wake up at 2:30 in the morning than I thought it would be.
I'll bet it was. Anyway, until tomorrow morning, same time, same station. Remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everybody.